From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Guy Raz. This episode, two cover stories. First, Americans' trust in religious institutions is at an all-time low, but does it mean religion is in decline?
I was raised Catholic, and I do believe in God, but I'm not sure I support institutionalized religion.
And then Mitt Romney is in Israel talking tough on Iran and courting pro-Israel voters.
No option should be excluded. We recognize Israel's right to defend itself and that it is right for America to stand with you.
A look at the competition for the pro-Israel voter, also the real and the fake, making the Olympics sound just right and mashing up music for the Olympics crowd. Plus, the Olympics party pooper writer Ian Sinclair, Beto Arco swings by with new music from Latin America, and how Matthew McConaughey came up with his most famous line.
All right, all right, all right.
Also, recreating the classic sounds of Motown.
There'll never be another you.
Detroit singer Mozella teams up with a Motown legend. That's all on this episode of Weekends and All Things Considered. There's something happening when it comes to religion in America. It's not clear if it's a permanent shift or just a sign of the times, but fewer and fewer Americans now trust religious institutions. In fact, a recent Gallup poll showed that trust at an all-time low. Just 44% of us have a great deal of confidence in organized religion. And according to a study by the Pew Forum on Religion that came out this week, almost two-thirds of Americans believe religion is losing influence in American life. For our cover story today, we're going to take a look at why more Americans seem to be turning their backs on the traditional church and, in many cases, opting for something different. We visited two churches recently, the Cathedral of the Holy Cross in Boston and the National Cathedral right here in Washington, where we put that question to parishioners.
My name is Joe Andrews, and I'm from Ashland, Oregon, and I am a Christian.
Helen Pomerico. I'm from the City of Champions, Brockton, Mass., and right now I'm on my way into the cathedral to say a prayer.
Religion, it's more for giving than receiving, and so therefore it allows us to commune with each other as well and pray for each other.
I was born and raised a Catholic, and I still go to church every week, and if I miss church, well, I say my prayers at home.
My name is Mercy Olumoye. I've been coming to Washington Cathedral for the past 20 years, and I love it.
Stephanie Macon. I'm from Buffalo, New York, and I'm 23.
Doesn't matter which church or where you are, as long as you can connect with God somehow, whatever you're asking for can be answered. I don't trust organized religion, period.
I'm Peggy Cleveland. Right now, I belong to the Disciples of Christ Church.
I was raised Catholic, and I do believe in God, but I'm not sure I support institutionalized religion.
I found that religion had very rigid beliefs that I believed at one time in my life, but came to question a lot, and I've just found another way.
Well, I mean, I don't attend church, but I'm not against religion. I think it teaches a lot of good things.
Voices from the Cathedral of the Holy Cross in Boston and the National Cathedral here in Washington, D.C. I asked NPR's religion correspondent, Barbara Bradley Haggerty, what she makes of that Gallup poll we mentioned earlier and whether it means we're becoming less religious.
No, it doesn't mean that America's less religious, although among young people, belief in God is declining. But generally, polls show about 90% of Americans actually believe in God. So what's happening here is there's really a decline in the trust in religious organizations. People just don't want to go to church as much as they used to. There's not the societal pressure to go. So what you're seeing is a problem for the institutions, not a problem for God.
I mean, you look at other so-called Christian countries, Western Europe, Australia. Right. The United States is by far the most religious country in the Western world, right?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. It ranks with, like, India.
Let's talk about who is growing and who isn't.
One type are the non-denominational Christian churches. Those have tripled in membership in the last 20 years or so. And these tend to be evangelical Protestant churches. And you also have to throw in some denominational churches like the Pentecostals as well. And they do two things really, really well that bring people in the door. Marketing and mystery. Okay, they have great music. They usually have rock and roll. It's often a professional
charismatic level.
It's very charismatic. The sermons are very relevant. You know, five ways the Sermon on the Mount will help your marriage. So you hear it on Sunday and you use it on Monday. So it's very, very relevant. You can wear jeans. You make friends. You join a small group or a Bible study. You have a community. At the center of every evangelical church is this notion that you can have a personal relationship with God. Because of that, they seem to give meaning and purpose to people's lives. It draws people in.
Barb, let me ask you about the other side of this equation, the unaffiliated, people who are not involved at all.
Right. The nuns, as in no affiliation, atheist, agnostic, they don't go to church or synagogue or mosque. It's doubled in their numbers in the last 20 years or so. There are a few reasons for it. You began to see this happen in the 1990s, where people got pretty disaffected by the rise of the religious right. They didn't like seeing the merging of religion and politics, especially conservative politics. And then neo-atheism became pretty popular with Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins, making it really cool to be an atheist. And so what's happened is that over the years, more and more people, especially young people, have been willing to come out of the closet, so to speak.
Barb, when you go to Western Europe, churches essentially are empty on Sunday. They are effectively museums. Does this poll suggest that that could happen in the United States?
You know, I think there's a big debate about whether we're going the way of Europe. There's one thing that we have that's very different, and that is we have a free market of religion. I mean, in Europe, you have established religion, state religion, and people lost interest. In America, you have your choices of like hundreds of different types of churches. You can go to anything you want. And what that means is that they're competing. And it means that they're thinking through, how do we bring people in the doors? It may suggest that we are not going to go the way of Europe.
That's NPR's religion correspondent, Barbara Bradley Haggerty. The sex abuse scandal is one of the biggest reasons Catholics have been expressing less and less confidence in their church over the past decade. Now, just 46% of Catholics do. And all of this, says Tom Roberts, editor-at-large for the National Catholic Reporter, it's all happening against a backdrop of what he calls a seismic shift taking place within the Catholic Church.
One of the most graphic examples of the shift is the sale of the Bishop's Mansion on City Line Avenue in Philadelphia. That's up for sale.
That's an iconic sort of building.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it was a palace. And the same with the Bishop's residence in Boston. And their campus, that whole thing was sold largely to pay off sex abuse payments and settlements. So you have a humbling of the church that's being caused by a whole lot of outside forces. But I think there are other things that are occurring that aren't directly related to the scandal. I mean, the demographers are also telling us that in 10 years, the number of priests available for service, and there are about 18,000 available for active diocesan service today, serving about that many parishes in the United States, will be halved because of age and infirmity and all the rest of it. There's no national effort yet to really imagine what this church will look like, what parishes will look like, what it will mean to pastor something, you know, in 2020. It's an open question at this point.
And in that future, the sort of the stereotype of the sort of Irish-American silver-haired priest or the Italian-American priest, that probably is not going to be the future either. I mean, presumably, the growth is going to be coming from Spanish-speaking communities.
Yes, and all of those old anchor images, all of those old, you know, givens that I grew up with in my era as a Catholic kid in the 50s and 60s, you can eliminate that. It's not going to be the same. There are 30,000, for instance, lay ministers who are being paid to do ministry in the Catholic Church today. That didn't exist 50 years ago. So the seismic shifts, the changes that we're sort of in the midst of, and sometimes we don't recognize because we're right in the middle of it all as it's going on, I think are significant. Where they lead, we're not certain, but things are changing rather dramatically.
In an article, you quoted a young Catholic 20-year-old, he said, you know, the church since my childhood has felt like a faith rooted in sincere virtue represented by a junta rooted in insincere vice.
Yeah, and that's
a junta.
A junta, yeah. It's a severe judgment of an institution that has not acted the way it says it should, in the way it demands of everyone else. All of the programs that were devised, the review boards and, you know, the degrees of accountability that bishops now are under and all that sort of thing. All of those were reactions to public pressure. Mm. Nothing happened voluntarily. What hasn't occurred is the bishop who comes out and says, Church, this is the number of priests we moved without telling anyone. Mm. This is the amount of money we paid for silence on this issue. This is the number of children who were damaged because we conducted ourselves this way. The community hasn't heard that in a way that we understand it sacramentally within our religious tradition and practice. The question today is, how do you inspire people to be Catholic? What is the community about? And I think that's a huge question today, given the mix of societal forces, the challenge that come out of the sex abuse crisis, and just the general disposition toward organized religion today.
That's Tom Roberts with the National Catholic Reporter. Now, while many traditional Protestant and Catholic churches are struggling with changes and lower participation, there is growth in other areas, particularly among non-denominational evangelical churches. Membership in these churches has grown over the past 20 years, and one reason for that is their approach. Sermons more like how-to guides and services more like rock concerts. This is from a recent Sunday service at Seacoast Church in Mount Pleasant, South Carolina. It's widely seen as one of the most influential non-denominational evangelical churches in America. Now, 25 years ago, when its founder, Pastor Greg Surratt, was starting out, evangelicals were the ones going through a crisis of trust, from Jim and Tammy Faye Baker to Jimmy Swaggart. Surratt says at the beginning, it was an uphill battle.
One of the things that we decided to do from early on was to try to be as transparent as we possibly could. We try to talk just like everybody else talks. We try to, you know, from a leadership point of view, live our lives as transparently as we can, knowing that people were predisposed at the time, and evidently continuing so, to be distrustful of some church organizations.
When you sort of consider this poll by Gallup and where Americans are with respect to their relationship to religious institutions, where do you see the future of Christianity going in this country? How do you see it evolving?
Well, I'm obviously prejudiced toward the church. I love the church. And I feel like when the local church is done well, there's no greater group of people on the planet when they're living according to what Jesus would teach. I think it's a great way of life. So I don't think it's going to go away. Will it change 10 years from now or 20 years from now? Will it look like it does today? Probably not. But I think that it will thrive and I think it will be strong.
That's Pastor Greg Surratt of Seacoast Church in Mount Pleasant, South Carolina. What started with 65 members a quarter century ago now has 12,000. Every 4 years, each presidential nominee works to outdo the other when it comes to his credentials on Israel. It's no different this time. Today, Mitt Romney is in Israel, where he tried to draw a distinction with President Obama by saying he'd respect an Israeli attack on Iran's nuclear facilities.
And it is our fervent hope that diplomatic and economic measures will do so. In the final analysis, of course, no option should be excluded. We recognize Israel's right to defend itself and that it is right for America to stand with you.
Just 2 days ago, President Obama, apparently feeling some heat over a perception among some that he isn't sufficiently pro-Israel, decided to hold a televised signing ceremony at the White House, a rare event, usually granted for major pieces of legislation. But this was for a relatively minor bill, the annual bill that provides U.S. military aid to Israel.
In many ways, what this legislation does is bring together all the outstanding cooperation that we have seen, really at an unprecedented level, between our two countries to underscore our unshakable commitment to Israel's security.
In previous weeks on this program, we've been taking a look at different groups of voters, for example, women and Latinos, and how the two campaigns are going after their votes. In a few weeks, we'll explore outreach to Asian American voters, but today, we're going to focus on the so-called pro-Israel voter, Jews and evangelicals, and most importantly, how much of that vote really matters. Our cover story today, why Republicans and Democrats are spending lots of time and money trying to win over the pro-Israel vote. Jewish Americans make up about 4% of the electorate, a small number. And ever since Al Smith ran for president in 1928, Democrats have, on average, won 75% of the Jewish vote. In 2008, nearly 80% of them backed Obama. So why the competition to get their votes? Well, because of a few key battleground states where some of those votes could make the difference, places like Ohio and Pennsylvania and Florida. And that's why so many groups, including the Republican Jewish Coalition, are spending millions for those few votes. Here's Matthew Brooks, the director of the RJC.
Well, I will tell you, the difference between 19% of the Jewish vote, which is what George W. Bush got in 2000, and 24 or 25%, which is what he got in 2004, was, you know, he won Florida by 537 votes in 2000. So a shift of the Jewish vote when there's 600,000 Jews in a place like Florida could have a very significant impact in a close election.
This week, the group launched the first in a series of ads that featured Jewish voters who claimed to have backed President Obama in 2008, but now say they're switching primarily because, they argue, President Obama hasn't been supportive of Israel.
I think in the second term, we're going to see the real Barack Obama. The real Barack Obama is not going to have any politics to deal with, any voters to deal with. I think he's going to change the game when it comes to Israel. He's going to place Israel in a position where they're in danger.
The RJC plans to spend $6.5 million this campaign season to unseat President Obama, a campaign financed largely by the billionaire Sheldon Adelson, a casino magnate who's pledged $100 million to anti-Obama super PACs. But is the RJC campaign going to make a difference? Here's Matthew Brooks again.
I concede that a majority of the Jewish voters will support Obama in 2012, but what I won't concede is the fact that the Republicans have consistently and unmistakably increased their market share among Jewish voters in four out of the last five national elections. If you go back to 1992, we got 11% of the Jewish vote. In 1996, we got 16% of the Jewish vote. In 2000, with George W. Bush, we got 19% of the Jewish vote. And in 2004, we got 24 or 25% of the Jewish vote, depending on what exit poll you use. Now, granted, in 2008, when Republicans were washed out across the board, we lost a couple points, but we only went down to 22% of the Jewish vote. So Republicans have been making clear inroads in the Jewish community. And I fully expect not only will we do so in 2012, but we'll do so in a real serious way.
A Gallup poll of Jewish voters released on Friday could be encouraging for Romney. 25% say they'll back him. Now, in its annual survey, the American Jewish Committee found that just a fifth of Jewish voters cited U.S.-Israel relations as a top priority when it comes to picking a candidate.
To read the media, you would often think that Israel is the defining political issue for American Jews. It's really not.
That's Peter Beinart, the editor of Open Zion, a blog about Israel and Palestine featured on the Daily Beast.
American Jews tend to vote, like everybody else, on things like the economy. And American Jews are very liberal in general, especially non-Orthodox American Jews, on cultural issues like abortion. If an American president were considered to be truly hostile to Israel, maybe that would be overriding. But I think most elections feature candidates who most American Jews consider to be good enough on Israel, and then they tend to vote on other issues.
So if Israel is not that important, why every 4 years do the major party candidates seem to pander to various constituencies, let's say Jews and evangelicals and others, on this question of Israel?
To be fair, presidential candidates pander to all kinds of different groups on all kinds of different issues. It's just that Jews tend to notice the pandering to them more. Jews also are overrepresented in financing presidential campaigns, especially political campaigns in general, especially in the Democratic Party. It's really no secret. The Democratic Party has relied very heavily for many years on the donations of American Jews. And so I think that Jews can wield disproportionate influence given their role in funding presidential campaigns in addition to their vote. And in a state like Florida, for instance, which is a swing state, even if you're only going to move a small number of American Jews on the Israel question, you still want to do everything you can, given that, as we saw in 2000, these elections can be decided by very small margins.
And as Peter Beinart mentioned, Florida is one of those places where the two candidates are focusing much of their attention. And so we sent a local producer, Shannon Novak, to a popular lunch spot near Miami to gauge some of those Jewish voters.
Okay, we're at Moe's Bagel and Deli in Adventure, Florida. What's the best thing to eat here, Mo?
The best things to eat? The tuna salad.
Tuna salad?
Tuna salad is the best.
Everyone we heard from at Moe's is Jewish, and we asked whether Mitt Romney's visit to Israel this weekend could be enough to get their votes.
Nope. Not at all.
It definitely makes me more interested.
Absolutely.
Absolutely not.
Well, Israel is the center of all our universe, I would say, especially in today's world.
He's doing it basically because we're going to be voting, and it's going to look good on for his campaign, but it's not going to change my mind.
I would vote for anyone but Obama, and I'm not voting him because he went to Israel. I'm voting for him because he's the right man for the job.
Romney has a long-standing relationship with Prime Minister Netanyahu. I know that he will be unequivocally a pro-Israel president should he be elected.
Most presidential candidates try to make a trip to Israel, and I feel like it's not really out of the ordinary.
More likely to vote for him? Of course. Why? Because I'm Jewish.
By all accounts, President Obama has continued America's strong backing for Israel. He's increased military ties, even military aid. Yet some Jewish voters say he isn't supportive enough. At Moe's Deli, for example, they cited his tense relationship with Israeli leader Benjamin Netanyahu and his call back in 2009 for Israel to halt settlement building in the occupied West Bank.
I was very disappointed in him when the Prime Minister of Israel came and I never saw him at the White House. So I was very disappointed in the president.
The announcement that he made a couple of years ago that Israel should return to its, you know, pre-1967 borders did not sit well with me.
The Palestinians say that they want to be able to send back an unlimited number of people into Israel. That eliminates Israel as a state. Obama is not raising the key issue.
I would probably like our president to have a more of a supportive position as far as Israel goes, but what I value is more a candidate's positions on domestic policy.
Now, there is another pro-Israel constituency that, if energized, could be a particular help to Mitt Romney, evangelicals. A Pew poll taken earlier this year found that 64% of self-identified evangelicals say protecting Israel should be a top priority. And what explains that view?
The theological basis for it is the biblical text that says, "He who blesses Israel, I will bless. He who curses Israel, I will curse."
That's Gary Bauer, chairman of American Values, a conservative public policy group. He's been a leading critic of President Obama on a variety of issues, including Israel. Can you estimate how many Christian Zionists there are in the U.S.?
You know, I've heard all kinds of numbers, but for example, I've been associated with the fantastic group that was founded by Pastor John Hagee in Texas, Christians United for Israel. And in just a few years, that group has gone from a handful of people meeting in San Antonio, Texas, to having over a million people on their Facebook page. We just had an annual convention here in town, somewhere between 5,000 and 6,000 people attended from all over the country. So it is an issue that resonates.
How do you believe Mitt Romney's visit to Israel could change the equation for him? Is that a trip that is designed to appeal to multiple constituencies, including constituencies like your own?
Governor Romney certainly has made it clear that he has significant problems with the president's foreign policy, and not the least of those, how things have gone in the Middle East. Certainly, the governor's political advisors must be aware that by making it clear that he will, as president, restore the more traditional relationship between the two countries is not only the right thing to do, but also would pay political dividends.
That's evangelical leader Gary Bauer, chairman of the conservative public policy group American Values. Coming up, we're going to continue our conversation on the politics of pursuing the pro-Israel voter with Stephen Walt. Stay with us. It's All Things Considered from NPR News. Before the break, we were talking about capturing the pro-Israel vote. Mitt Romney is in Israel this weekend to do just that. We called Harvard professor Stephen Walt, author of the book The Israel Lobby, to ask whether there's any political advantage to taking a tougher line on Israel during campaign season.
We've never seen anyone run for president saying that they're going to be strictly even-handed, they're going to bring tough love to both sides. Rather, what you see in every election is both candidates, Republicans and Democrats, pandering. And there's no constituency on the other side that you would win by adopting the sort of more even-handed position. The Arab American community or the Palestinian American community is simply not as politically potent. So you've got almost nothing to gain by adopting that as your public campaign position, and you've got at least something potentially to lose.
So when you hear Mitt Romney say, for example, as he has said, that he will do precisely the opposite on Israel that President Obama has done, he, of course, is trying to suggest that he would be more of an advocate and ally for Israel. You would argue that there is almost no daylight in reality between what either of these candidates stand for when it comes to Israel.
There's an irony here that some have pointed to, that if he did exactly the opposite of what President Obama has done, he would, of course, get rid of all American economic and military assistance to Israel, something President Obama has enthusiastically supported. If he did the opposite of President Obama, he wouldn't have the United States vetoing Security Council resolutions that are critical of Israel. In fact, President Obama, like all of his predecessors, has been very, very supportive of Israel. There has clearly been a disagreement over what, say, the settlement package, and he has had some disputes with the Israeli government about that because Obama believes a two-state solution is in everyone's best interest and doesn't think the Israeli government has been as willing to take steps in that direction. But I think the idea that a Romney would be substantially more supportive is simply wrong.
Well, what do you make of this idea, Stephen Walt, that now more Americans call themselves pro-Israel than at any other time since President Johnson's administration? Why do you think that is?
I think there's, been a longstanding effort by pro-Israel groups in the United States to portray a very favorable image of Israel to the American people, and this has been quite successful. So Americans often don't have a particularly clear picture of everything that's going on there. There are many things to admire about Israeli society, but there's also some things that I think are deeply troubling, in particular the harsh treatment meted out to the Palestinians. I think the second part is that, rightly or wrongly, Americans have tended to adopt a rather black-white view of the Middle East, where Israel is seen as our friend and the Arabs are seen as terrorists or sympathetic to terrorists or not very pro-American, and that has tended to solidify an image of Israel as being just like us. And finally, it's politically costly in the United States because of the influence of groups like AIPAC and others to say anything critical. Even when Israel does things we don't want them to do, we tend to use rather mild language. You put that all together, and the average American has a somewhat sanitized view of the country and probably a more favorable image than might be completely warranted.
That's Stephen Walt, a professor of international relations at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. Stephen Walt, thank you so much.
Pleasure talking with you.
Over the next few weeks, we'll get to hear those sounds that most of us only hear every 4 years.
Set.
They are the sounds of the Olympics, of course, and the man behind them all is Dennis Baxter. He's the official sound designer for the Games, and he has been since Atlanta in 1996.
And the sound design is figuring out exactly what you want a sport to sound like, and then do a microphone plan that is necessary to deliver the highest possible quality sound to engage the viewer and to, fundamentally for me, to satisfy the expectations of a viewer.
Now, this is actually, and I didn't realize this, is a relatively new thing. Back, if you watched the Olympics in before 1996, before you became the Olympic sound engineer, the Olympics sounded considerably different, and I want to play some samples of that. This is a clip from the archery event from the Seoul Olympics in 1988, before you, the Olympics had people like you doing the sound. Okay, that's the archery event from 1988. Let's hear the archery event from the Beijing Olympics in 2008. This is the one that you mic'd. Wow, you actually hear that arrow flying through the air, like that whoosh, whoosh, whoosh.
Exactly.
That's incredible. How did you do that?
Well, it all starts with what I expect to hear, what I want to hear, and certainly the sound of sports has been influenced significantly by film and currently by games. So as a child, I remember the movie Robin Hood, And there was this hyper sound that that I remember. And with the archery event, I wanted to hear the sound of the arrow. I wanted to hear what you cannot hear anywhere else. And that's fundamentally where I start.
So what did you? How did you set up the microphones to capture the sound of the arrow flying through the air?
I put the microphone in line of the pathway of the arrow so that you hear as the arrow moves across toward the target, you actually hear it go across the microphone and you get that type of sound.
Dennis, let's hear another example. This is a gymnastics. This is from the Montreal Olympics, 1976. This is a famous moment. Nadia Comăneci of Romania scoring the first ever perfect 10 on the uneven bars. This is what it sounded like.
Watch this. She is really moving well. Another handstand. Look at that, right to the handstand.
Okay, we don't hear any gymnastics there. We hear the announcer. Let's hear, this is from the Beijing Olympics 2008. This is Beth Tweddle of the UK during a qualifying round, also on the uneven bars. That is so cool. You hear everything there. I mean, you could just listen to that on the radio and build a picture in your mind's eye.
Well, exactly what you said. To me, it is somewhat based on radio, but it's theater of the mind. I absolutely subscribe to the philosophy that you should be able to close your eyes and know exactly where you are.
Let's hear one of the probably the most challenging things that anybody could record. This is rowing. And rowing, I should mention, to capture rowing by video, you have to follow the crew from a helicopter. This is from the Atlanta Games in 1996. This is what it sounded like.
And in the semifinal, they were 0.04 of a second behind France, the fastest qualifier. Now, Romania still hits Australia, still by about a canvas.
Okay, as I say, 1996, Atlanta, you mostly hear a helicopter. Let's listen to the Beijing rowing event from 2008. This is what it sounded like. Okay, you actually hear the sounds of the oars in the water, that rowing sound. How did you do that?
I did Atlanta as well, and it was the only time I got a call from my boss, Manolo Romero, but he said, all I hear is noise. I hear motor noise, and he just said, fix it. So I took my portable DAT recorder out to the lake, and we followed different boaters, and we basically, you know, recorded the micro sound and then put it up into a sampler. Now, that was the first time that had ever really been done, and using samplers in rowing has become standard because of the fact rowing is covered by four or five chase boats and helicopter. So your entire sound field is just a wash of noise. So you don't stand a chance. Some people think it's cheating. I don't think I'm cheating anybody because back again to expectations. You see rowers. You don't see motorboats. And you have certain sounds that you would expect rowing to sound like. So I feel like I'm cheating my audience if I don't deliver those sounds.
So you're saying that the rowing event is the Milli Vanilli of Olympic events. This is all lip syncing.
I wouldn't say the Milli Vanilli. what I call, it's basically live Foley.
I got it. Okay.
The sound is there. It is the exact sound. It's just not necessarily real time because of the laws of physics. You got one noise masking another noise. So it's, as I said, the when you see a rower, your mind thinks you should hear the rower. And that's what we deliver.
That's Dennis Baxter. He's the official sound engineer for the Olympic Games. He spoke to us from London. Dennis Baxter, thank you so much, and thanks for making the Games more interesting.
Thank you, Guy.
Those Olympic sounds are worth a closer listen. To hear them, go to our website, npr.org. You'll find them in our Olympics blog, The Torch. Now for some Olympic music. Jordan Roseman, better known as DJ Earworm, is a pretty famous mashup artist.
Which means that I make music that's entirely cut up from previously existing music.
So he can take this Olympic fanfare and mash it up with, say, a song by hip-hop star Pitbull. And why would he do that? Well, because the International Olympic Committee asked him to create about 10 different mashup tracks using all kinds of pop songs to play at venues, stadiums, arenas, all during the Olympic Games. Stop, So what? How did this happen? One day, like, the International Olympic Committee called you and said, "Hey."
Pretty much. They, you know, out of the blue, there was an email, and they wanted these mixes.
Now, each song Roseman created has a loose theme. There's one with only top British female singers, one that combines songs about rain to play if an event is delayed because of weather, and this one you've been hearing, Roseman calls it gold.
Like Flo Rida says, good feeling. You know, it's like you've just won. The world is really good right at this moment. We're shining and it's perfect.
Wow. DJ Earworm, I'm hearing, let's see, I got Dynamite by Tayo Cruz, Don't Stop Believing by Journey, and then it goes into Eye of the Tiger by Survivor, man.
Yeah, there's some classical music, and, you know, you'll hear some hip-hop in there. It goes on.
Wow. All right, let's talk about another one. This one's a song you call Faster, Stronger. We're talking about athletes pushing the limit, I'm assuming, right? That sort of thing?
Yeah.
Okay, let's hear this one. Okay, that's the beginning. A little Ramones there. Later, you've got this amazing pairing of Bruce Springsteen and the teen boy band One Direction. Baby, we were born to run. Man. Yes, girl, we won. Wow, that's amazing. Did did you get permission from Bruce Springsteen? Would he be cool with that?
You know, this is not for distribution. This is, you know.
So. By the way, sorry, Bruce. Go ahead.
And so we have a lot of leeway of what we can do.
So how do you come up with that in your head? Are you just thinking? Are you listening to Born to Run and then you're thinking, hey, you know, I really like that song by One Direction. I think they go together.
Well, it's funny because I want half the mix to be about running and half the mix to be about being strong. And so Born to Run is just iconic. And strap your hands, cross my engines. Then I realized, oh, that One Direction song, it's in the same key and the same tempo. At first I was just thinking, wouldn't it be funny? And then I put it together and I was like, well, it is funny, but it actually sounds good.
Okay, so the beginning of your gold mix, right? This is where you've got the song Give Me Everything by Pitbull. And it's over the Olympic theme song, which apparently is not the Olympic theme song.
No, it's the Bugler's Dream, which NBC and ABC play. It's funny because I gave them the mix, and they actually asked me what that music was. I was shocked, and I went on Wikipedia, and I realized, oh, that's the Olympic theme from an American.
So if you watch this, it's crazy. If you watch the Olympics in Russia, you would not hear that theme song.
No.
We've been brainwashed, yeah. Jordan Roseman, also known as DJ Earworm, his Olympic mashups, including this last one called Hello, will be heard at venues and stadiums during the next few weeks at the 2012 Olympic Games in London. And you're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Sinclair had his way, the Olympics would not be in London at the moment. Sinclair is a Londoner, a writer, and probably one of the city's most miserable residents at the moment. He's frustrated with the traffic, the security precautions, the costs, and architecture he calls ghastly. Sinclair is best known as a psychogeographer. A few years ago, for his book London Orbital, he walked the entire length of the M25, the 117-mile highway that loops around the city of London. This time around, Sinclair has trained his sometimes unforgiving eye on how the city, and in particular, his East London neighborhood, were transformed in the run-up to the Games. The book is called Ghost Milk, Recent Adventures Among the Future Ruins of London on the Eve of the Olympics. Olympic organizers promised to revitalize a part of London they called a wasteland, but that wasteland is what Ian Sinclair calls home.
The reality is there was an awful lot there. There were thousands of people who lived there. There were communities of various sorts, allotments, gardens, rowing clubs, cycling clubs, football units, all of which have been cleared away to create this rather beautiful computer-generated image. We'll see how that goes. This is my particular vision of a future ruin.
These are the stadiums and the venues for some of the different Olympic events you're talking about, and you sort of imagine walking through them as we walk through, say, I don't know, the Forum in Rome today or something like that.
Yes, because this was my experience too when I went to Athens as part of this book. I was looking at the much more beautiful stadium they had there and the landscape, the glittering landscape around it, and seeing it more or less abandoned with the economic collapse in Greece. Wildlife was growing up through the abandoned stadiums. There were packs of feral dogs. There were people selling cheap watches and all of that. And I spoke to a young Greek architect and said, "Are you not uncomfortable with this? This was a great moment. And now look at them." And he said, Oh, no. We are a culture of ruins. We knew they would be ruins, and we were very happy about it. They're just a new kind of ruin."
As you know, of course, living in London, the Olympics, this is a huge moment of pride for the British government, for London city officials, for many people in the city and in the country. And for you, this is just a moment of disaster. This is a nightmare.
It's a moment of a kind of disaster, or at least a challenge, a big challenge, for the people who are the nearest to it. The further you step back from it, the easier it is to look on it as a great event. When you're close, it actually becomes an invaded city. We have armed helicopter gunships flying overhead to shoot down any planes that come within. And where are they going to crash? We've got surface-to-air missiles put on top of occupied blocks of flats. We've got more troops in place now than have been used in the whole of the Afghan campaign. And the hysteria around this, the moment of global athletic challenge, is creating a kind of agreement between local politics, mainstream politics, and the mass media that this is a great and important moment for the country. To some extent, the local people feel excluded because there are great reservoirs of poverty very close to where the site is.
I'm speaking with the author Ian Sinclair. His new book is called Ghost Milk, Recent Adventures Among the Future Ruins of London on the Eve of the Olympics. One of the ideas behind the area that was chosen for most of the construction in East London was to revitalize that area. Obviously, part of that is successful, isn't it?
Well, that's the pitch, to revitalize the area, but it isn't actually the truth. It's meant an expulsion for the poorer people of the area, people who cannot now achieve the rents demanded because it's an Olympic borough, have been put on buses and are invited to go off to the English provinces. And where I live in Hackney, which is a contingent Olympic borough, it's right alongside, near lots of the brand new developments, which look quite exciting, I am aware of 30 to 40 people sleeping rough on the streets. We're boasting of new sports facilities coming in. They tend to be for an elite. There is a beautiful velodrome that will be for the elite British cyclists, but the old cycle track that was there in Hackney Wick, which was available to all of the local children and people who took to cycling for the first time, that is no longer there. It's gone. What we badly need are new bridges across the river. We need some practical engineering. And what we're getting is this sort of smoke and circuses affair that's intended to take our minds off it and order us to be in a celebratory mode. We will celebrate. You know, there will be great moments. But I don't think that's the deep reality that's underlying it all.
Do you wish that the Olympics would not have been held in London?
Very much so. You know, I remember the moment when we got them. There was this moment of wild celebration. And the very next morning in London was when the series of bombs went off in the transport system. So there was already a sense of threat. And incipient paranoia was hanging over the whole process. And the security budgets leapt on that one day, you know, by many billions. And it was said that this would have to be the most secure games that had ever been held. And from my point of view, what was really authentically an international moment to celebrate with the smaller Olympic Games, the thing had become so inflated, it was unworkable.
Will you watch any of the Olympics on TV?
I will even attend.
Oh, I see. Because, you actually have tickets for an event.
Well, there's a slight family difference of point of view here. My wife thinks this is a spectacle once in a lifetime that could not be missed, even though she agrees with me about so much that's happened. So she said, I don't care what you think, we're going. So we're going to be seeing the final of the 200 meters, and I'll be enjoying it all for 19 seconds or whatever, for which we've suffered a long 5 or 6 years.
That's writer Ian Sinclair, author of the new book Ghost Milk, Recent Adventures Among the Future Ruins of London on the Eve of the Olympics. It's Weekends and All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz, and it's time now for music. And today, global music DJ Beto Arcos is back to share some of his favorite new Latin American artists, including this track from Colombia. Beto is a regular on this program and the host of Global Village on KPFK in Los Angeles, where he joins us from our studios at NPR West. Beto, thanks so much for being with us.
Great to be with you, Guy.
Great to have you back. This song, Beto, this is Michael Jackson's Don't Stop Till You Get Enough, right?
That's right.
Am I imagining that?
No, you're exactly right.
Oh, I am? Really? It is that song?
Yes. It's a cumbia rendition of that Michael Jackson tune, yeah.
Who is the band?
This is a band called Los Míticos del Ritmo. They were brought together by the English DJ Will Holland, who goes by the name of Quantic. He moved to Cali, Colombia, a few years ago to explore the roots of traditional Colombian music. Here, he is playing the accordion himself, if you can believe it, and squeezing that juice out of that amazing instrument to play this fantastic version of Don't Stop Till You Get Enough. I just love this idea of this sort of very upbeat dancing tune by Michael Jackson, but turn into a funky cumbia.
It's awesome. That's a Colombian band, Los Míticos del Ritmo. Beto, I was told before you arrived in the studio that all of the artists that you brought us today share one thing in common. They are all playing traditional Colombian dance music, cumbia.
That's right. Cumbia has become the coolest and the hippest dance music all over Latin America and in the U.S. too. You know, the music comes from Colombia, and bands from all over the continent are reinterpreting this style in their own way. Now we're going to hear from a band in Mexico called Sonido Gallo Negro, and they take a style of cumbia from Peru, which is called chicha, not to be confused with chicha the drink, which is a corn drink. This is chicha the music, and they fuse it with other sounds to create a completely new sound. Let's check it out. This song is called Cumbia Espantamuertos, which translates as cumbia to scare the dead. When you hear this music, you can almost hear the score of a film noir, don't you think?
Yeah,
it's
very
largely
noir,
due
yeah.
to that. You know that instrument called the theremin?
Oh, the theremin, yeah.
Yeah, they use that in here in the background. You can hear it a little bit. This theremin creates a kind of mysterious, quasi-scary sound. It really brings home that idea that this is a tune to scare the dead.
Okay, Beto, let's move on to this next artist we're hearing. This is the Uruguayan artist named Campo, I understand, right? I'm hearing clearly a major shift here from what we just heard.
Yeah, that's right. This is Campo. It's a project of producer-guitarist Juan Campodónico, but it goes just by the name of Campo. Now, Campo means field, and the idea here is that it's an open field where he creates all kinds of music, and this is a field of cumbia, where he brings together this idea of the cumbia villera, which is the cumbia that flourished in the mid-90s in the working class areas of Uruguay and Argentina. And he mixes it with this kind of Brit pop sound with this great singer, Martin Rivero, on vocals.
What was I looking for? Something's in my mind. Something's in my mind. Something's in my mind.
Petro, I was expecting to hear him sing in Spanish. He is actually singing in English like a Brit pop singer, like he sounds British.
That's right, because it turns out that he was educated in a British school in Uruguay. Uh-huh. But it's a great kind of contrast of this sort of working class sound with this sort of dark Brit pop, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you want to get tangled up? Do you want to confess? Do you want to get tangled up? Do you want to confess? What was I looking for?
Beto, I'm hearing our last song. This is, unfortunately, sadly, we have time for just one more. What I'm hearing now sounds a lot more traditional than the last couple tracks.
Yeah, we're going to go back to Colombia on this track and back to Quantic, the first artist we heard from. This is a band called Onda Trópica. It's an all-star collective of Colombian musicians that Mario Galeano of the band Frente Cumbiero, I don't know if you remember, we talked about him before.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
And Quantic have brought together these old cats to record with younger musicians. And the result is absolutely fantastic. Listen to this big band cumbia.
Qué linda la mañana cuando sale el sol. Qué linda la mañana cuando sale el sol. La vida se ennoblece con su resplandor. La vida se ennoblece con su resplandor. Que los ritmos de Colombia. La cumbia en la matrona.
The song is called Linda Mañana, or Beautiful Morning. It's an example of the cumbia that you would have heard back in the 60s and 70s, you know, with the big brassy sound and the heyday, the golden age of cumbia in Colombia. And for this particular recording, they went back to the old Discos Fuentes studios in Medellin, Colombia, the label that put out the best Colombian music back in the day. And they brought back the same engineer that worked on those records. And they recorded on reel to reel. And what you hear, this kind of big band recreating the old sound for the 21st century. Just heavenly stuff.
It's fantastic. The band is called Onda Trópica, and they're just one of the many artists you can hear on Beto Arcos' show, Global Village, on KPFK in Los Angeles. Beto, thanks so much for popping by, and we'll talk to you again in a couple weeks.
Thank you for having me.
This past week, actor Matthew McConaughey sat down with us to talk about the recent and radical shift in his career and the somewhat darker roles he's been taking. But before we got there, he told us the story of how he got into acting, and particularly how he was cast as the slightly sleazy character Wooderson in the 1993 film Dazed and Confused. It began at a bar in Austin, Texas. McConaughey struck up a conversation with Don Phillips, the producer, who was in town looking for actors for the film.
Cut to 3.5 hours later, we've been kicked out of So Said Bar, and he says, "You ever acted before?" And I said, "Well, I mean, I was in a Miller Lite commercial for about that long." And he said, "Well, there's a role in this film you might be just right for. Come to this address and pick up the script if you're interested, and come tomorrow morning." 9:30 that next morning, I went down to this place, and there was a script waiting for me with a handwritten note. And for me, well, Wooderson was, it was not who my brother, my middle brother, was as a senior in high school, but at 11 years old, it's who I thought he was. And I had a wonderfully romanticized view of him. To me, he was 8 feet tall. His 81 Z28 Camaro was a rocket. His sound system, the Tancredi Equalizer Alpine system and Concord speakers, was better than Phil Spector's wall of sound. I was working off these images of who he was when I was 11 years old. And then I went to the set, did a wardrobe fitting one night, walk out, Richard Linklater sees me, he laughs, he goes, "Yep, that's Wooderson." And I said, "All right, well, I'll see you next week." And he goes, "No, don't go anywhere yet." He goes, "We're shooting this scene at the Top Notch. It's Friday night, school just got out. Don't you think Wooderson might be hanging around here?"
"All right, let's rock and roll."
And I said, "Well, yeah, he'd be hanging around here." We smiled at each other, and he goes, "You want to shoot it?" And I said, "Yeah." And I got in my car, the 70 Chevelle, very nervous, about to go on screen for the very first time in my life. And I'm going through in my head, what is Wooderson about? And I said, you know what? Wooderson's about four things. He's about his car. He's about his weed.
Say, man, you got a joint?
He's about rock and roll, and he's about chicks. And as they were counting down to say action, it hit me. I said, I'm in my car. I'm high. I'm listening to rock and roll. And right over there, there's the chick. And they said, action. And I said, that's three out of four. So let's give them a...
All right, all right, all right.
All right, all right, all right. And I pulled out. And that was the kickstart. First words I ever said on screen. Still one of the lines that I hear people say. And I still repeat myself.
That film launched Matthew McConaughey's career, a career in which he's come to dominate the romantic comedy genre. But after years of playing the sly, grinning ladies' man, McConaughey started rejecting those scripts. And in 2009, he decided to take a break from acting entirely.
I was looking at some things and saying, you know what, I like that, and I could do that tomorrow. And there's nothing wrong with reading something or seeing something that you feel like you can do tomorrow. But I was like, let's just hold off, McConaughey, and let's sit back and see if something comes and intrigues me that I do not feel like I could do tomorrow, that I feel like I could do it, but I got to go to work and figure out how I can do it. And as the world works in that wonderfully cyclical way, I started to attract exactly what I was looking for. All of a sudden, I got a call. You know, I met with Richard Linklater about Bernie. Then I get a call from Wim Friedkin. We have a meeting. And Steven Soderbergh calls for the first time. Lee Daniels, Jeff Nichols with Mud. Very independent and singular-minded directors and very singular-willed characters that were, you know, no pandering to society or anyone's rules really but their own.
Let's wind back for a moment and talk a little bit about how you got to that point, because, I mean, your acting career, your breakout role was in an independent film, Dazed and Confused, with Richard Linklater. And then somehow you kind of became known for playing these romantic leads in these very successful comedies. I mean, you just sort of sat back and said, I'm done with that. I don't want to be that character anymore.
Well, to be fair, and specifically like with a romantic comedy, it's a genre and a formula that you can only do so much with. You know you're going to meet the guy and the girl early on. You know they're going to get in a fight, and you know the guy's going to chase her at the end and get her. The challenge is, how do you make that fun and engaging and keep it buoyant? But it's basically that same story. I just felt like there was nothing really there that was scaring me or really challenging me.
Matthew, I want to ask you about the film Magic Mike, which, of course, is in theaters now. A lot has been said about what you brought to the character in that film, Dallas. He is this kind of sleazy nightclub owner, former exotic dancer.
All right, rule number one, this is the what can you touch and not touch rule. Can you touch it? Can you touch it? No, 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 no.
Some critics have said, you know, it's almost as if Matthew McConaughey is poking fun at a parody of himself.
I've read that a couple of times, too. It made me get a little quizzical when I first read it. I then kind of chuckled and said, well, you know what? I'll take that as a compliment.
I think it's a compliment, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard, that a lot of people love that they go, well, Dallas plays the bongos, and he plays the congas, and he plays the djembe, and that's a callback to 1999 when you were arrested in your birthday suit. And I
which something
actually,
that really happened, we should say.
It did. That did really happen. Yes. Yeah, that's a fact. And I never thought of it like that, but I will say this. As soon as I said, oh, Dallas, this MC, this P.T. Barnum of this circus, he's got to play the drums here, got to play the congas here. And then after I pulled him out, I was like, oh, yeah, well, yeah, objectively, people are going to see Dallas playing the congas, and they're going to go, that's McConaughey in full regale. You know, we know that about McConaughey. And I was like, well, that's a nice wink. You know, and I mean, there's another thing about, I think there for a couple of years, I did three summer movies and had three summers where I was fortunate enough to be in weather where I could go shirtless. And then when I was doing Dallas, and after we got done, I think I got asked the first question in press, and it came to my lips. I said, well, yeah, I was doing some character research for this guy for the last few years, but this Dallas guy, he's a real evolution for me, because this guy's dropping his pants.
I'm speaking with the actor Matthew McConaughey. His new film is called Killer Joe, and it opened in theaters this weekend. In this new film, Killer Joe, you play Joe Cooper, who is a sociopathic cop, and he's also a serial killer.
Now, I only have a couple of rules that I insist on sticking to. Insist.
Okay, yeah.
If you're caught, if you're implicated in this crime, you are not, under any circumstances, to reveal my identity or participation.
Oh, of course.
If you break this rule, you'll be killed.
It's not the first time you have played a killer. You did in the 2002 film Frailty. But I think it's safe to say a lot of your fans are not going to be used to seeing you like this. It's at times a disturbing film and role. What attracted you to that character?
I read it, and I did not get it the first time I read it. I actually thought it was despicable. I remember throwing the script in the trash and saying I don't want to be any part of that world. The second read of this, I found myself finding the small chuckles. And that was the light that revealed the humanity of the character for me, and also the meter of Tracy Letts's writing, which when the first read, I was like, some of the spots, I was like, this isn't even good writing. And what I found in the second read was that everything Tracy writes and what the characters say, and more importantly, what they don't say, is very deliberate. The pauses, the incomplete sentences, the non-linear responses to questions that the characters have with each other. Once I understood that meter and that rhythm, it started to reveal who Joe was to me.
You've been working pretty much nonstop. I don't know how you did these five or six roles. I don't know how you found time to do it. But is this basically, I mean, do you see this as kind of the direction in which you're headed, these character roles, less of the kind of the romantic leads? I mean, do you think that you're done with romantic leads?
I wouldn't say I'm done with the romantic comedies, but what I'm doing right now, I am feeling the experience of the work. The last five films, which I did back to back, I didn't have one day where I even had 60 seconds of complacency. Every single day, I'm fortunate to say, I got out of bed a little nervous and very excited about the work at hand. I never got bored. That's a goal, to get there. And if I can work to get to that place and find characters where I can understand the identity as well as I've understood the identity of these guys I've been playing, that would be just peachy.
That's actor Matthew McConaughey. He stars in five films this year, including Killer Joe, which opened this weekend. Matthew McConaughey, thank you so much.
Guy, you're welcome. I enjoyed talking to you, and I enjoy the show.
And if you're just joining us, this is Weekends and All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz, and it's time now for music. When I woke up, oh, I took a good look at my face. This is a singer who calls herself Mozella, and this song, Another You, it just sounds instantly familiar, doesn't it? Well, there's a good reason for that. It was co-written by someone who practically wrote the Great American Songbook. Can you believe Brian Holland co-wrote all of these songs? Whenever you think of that Motown sound, that was Brian Holland. And now, after a long break from the public eye, he's working with Mozella, born and bred in the Motor City. Mozella's new record is called The Brian Holland Sessions. Her real name is Maureen McDonald, and she joins me right here in the studio. Mozella, welcome to the program.
Hi.
This song, it's incredible. This is going to make a lot of people listening happy. It's just, it's so reminiscent of classic Motown, you know. When you went into the studio, did you have that as your mission statement?
Yes, absolutely. Basically, my publisher, John Platt, said, I have somebody on the phone you need to talk to. He's from your hometown, and he's written a few hits.
And you were a singer there.
And I'm a singer, yeah. And I'm signed with EMI as a writer. And I thought, oh, my God, who's he going to put me on the phone with? And he says, I want you to talk to Brian Holland. And I was walking across Santa Monica Boulevard, and I had lost my voice, and I'm trying to talk to him above traffic. And he was just so nice to me. And he said, we're going to write. And I said, okay. Okay, so we went in to write, but, you know, I had made a few albums. I was signed to a couple majors.
And you were writing for other people.
I was writing for other people. So when I went in, I was thinking he wanted to just songwrite.
Yeah.
And I thought, what an amazing opportunity to learn from this legend as a songwriter. I couldn't have picked a better mentor. And so we went in, and from the minute we met, it was like long-lost souls, just the best of friends instantly. We wrote one song, and he said, I want to make an album with you. I said, with me? And he's like, yeah, I want to do it with you. And I said, okay, I can't really say no to this. You know, I'm kind of in the mindset of transitioning into just being a writer and just doing, like, commercials like I'd been doing. And I said, but if we do this, I want to make it sound just like 1965.
Oh, wow.
He said, why do you want to sound like that? That's old. And I said, no, being from Detroit and you being from Detroit, no better way to, like, make an album. Let's just do it really, like, vintage. And he's like, well, whatever you want to do, you take the lead, I'll follow. I think about you everywhere that I go. What am I missing? Why am I needing this so? No way to stop the pain. I'm losing control. Bringing love, I'm back. Never let me go. Baby, why don't you save me? I just knew I wanted to make that sound. And I even had people that were like, well, don't you want to add some hip-hop to it? Don't you want to add this? I said, no. I wanted something really old and dirty and kind of janky. and they're like, really? And I'm like, yeah, I don't care if radio doesn't play it. I don't care if nobody plays it. I just want to make something that sounds like what my mom grew up on and loved, what she played me, what's in our DNA for every Detroiter. I just want to make an homage to the city that I grew up in. So I didn't listen to anybody. I had no A&R telling me what to do. I didn't have a record label. I didn't have a budget. I didn't have nobody. And so I said, let's just make music. Let's just enjoy each other's company and make music. And that's really what we did. We spent more time at IHOP eating breakfast and singing Nat King Cole songs together than we did writing this album.
It's amazing because you could take this CD, you could put it in the CD player, you could give it to a station and say, here's a lost record from 1965. You know those, it's like those Instagram. You ever use Instagram mm-hmm. on the iPhone?
Mm-hmm.
And you can get a photograph, and then you can kind of put a filter on it and give it that 70s veneer. And it looks, actually, it's so cool. It looks fresh.
Yeah.
It's the way I felt about this record, is that it takes you back, but that sound is so fresh right now.
I really appreciate that, because I feel like I got a little bit of resistance for wanting to do it so old sounding, because people were like, well, you know, Duffy and Amy Winehouse, they had this and they had beats underneath, and I said, I don't want that.
And you guys could have made a record of remakes, but you wrote all of the songs together.
We did. We would go in, we'd eat our breakfast, we'd share some French toast, and then we would laugh and talk and sit down at the piano. And we really only probably spent about 20 minutes at the piano. And he would start pounding on his left hand, and you'd hear this sound, and you'd be like, oh my God, wait, this is this song. I'm like, no, that's not it. And you realize he invented that sound. Back and forth, stuck in the middle of love and hate. Can't solve the riddle, she broke your heart. Taught you the pieces, you're all alone. I know what you're needing, boy, it's all right. Love takes time. There you are, right in the thick of it, broken up. I know you're sick of it. How come love just make you want to quit? Build a sandcastle to watch the water ruin it. It's all right. I know my mother, being raised in Detroit in the 60s, when she hears this, she's like overwhelmed, really overwhelmed. She used to babysit and call down to the Motown studio just to talk to people there. And they put Four Tops on the phone when she was 14, and she talked to them, you know. Or she remembers hearing Bernadette in the hamburger stand for the first time. And so for my mother, this is really like a very proud moment. As a Detroiter, it's a proud moment.
That is a singer known as Mozella. Her new album is called The Brian Holland Sessions. You can hear a few tracks at our website, nprmusic.org. Mozella, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
For the week ending July 29th, 2012. That's the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. This week, our program was directed by Lauren Silverman and edited by Kenya Young. Our production staff includes Phil Harrell, Brent Bachman, Lily Percy, Sanaz Meshkinpour, Amy Held, and Beenish Ahmed. Michael Tomsik is our intern, Mathoni Maturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Guy Raz. We're back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. Thanks for tuning in.